Reading Megan Ramos's book, The Essential Guide to Intermittent Fasting for Women, reminded me of when years ago I read Duffy's Sugar Blues. Huge impact. Made it easy to follow the suggestion. IF, intermittent fasting for many, has transformed health and transformed many futures. I'm Robin. Stay tuned for Tributaries. Megan, along with Dr. Fung, you started the first intermittent fasting clinic in North America, and there's so much more to the story than weight loss. So regarding good health, would you say that time-restricted eating is good for everyone, whereas intermittent fasting is for working with disease and/or weight loss, and how are they different?
Yeah, that's a great question. So time-restricted eating is fantastic for everyone. So what that essentially means is you're going back to the basics of how our grandparents, great-grandparents grew up. I always call it the Leave It to Beaver days. I don't know if anyone remembers that show, but going back in time, you know, those kids and family, they ate 3 times a day, and they weren't allowed to eat after school because they would ruin their appetite for their dinner. And if they were hungry before bed, it meant they didn't eat enough of their broccoli at their meal. So for a lot of even modern day human history, we only ate 3 times a day. We didn't constantly snack and graze all day long. And this resulted in naturally fasting 12 to 14 hours a day. I'm a pregnant woman right now, and it's so important that my baby gets all of the nutrients, all of the, you know, important calories that they can get throughout the day. But I don't have to eat 20 times a day for it to get all of those nutrients. And I don't have to eat from the time I wake up to the time I go to bed either. So time-restricted eating in general, what we're doing is we're limiting the amount of time that we eat every day to minimize the number of times of insulin that we produce a day. Now, insulin is what's really problematic. When we eat in a certain way, that causes toxic levels of insulin to accumulate within the body. Or we eat with a certain frequency, which constantly overwhelms and bombards our cells with our own insulin. We develop a condition called insulin resistance. And this leads to that unwanted weight gain around our midsection and metabolic diseases, everything from fatty liver disease, polycystic ovary syndrome, to type 2 diabetes and beyond. So time-restricted eating is just a great way to minimize the number of times that we're producing insulin every day. So we can limit that pathway of developing insulin resistance. So one of the ways we develop insulin resistance is from that chronic stimulus of insulin. I always joke that it's kind of like that when that Adele song, Hello, came out. I love Adele. She's one of my favorite singers of all time. And I think, you know, I've just loved all of her music. So she had this great album that came out, a huge hit. And then she went off, got married, had a son, and lived her life for a while. And a lot of people missed her. So she came back after her baby with this great hit song called Hello. And Hello played on the radio all the time, in the waiting rooms, elevators, change rooms, shopping malls. And one day I was driving home from clinic, and 8 of my 12 preset radio stations were playing Hello by Adele. And I just wanted to scream goodbye to Adele because I had developed Adele resistance because I was just bombarded with her song all day long. So our current guidelines tell us that we need to eat all day long, or at least several times throughout the day. But we're constantly bombarding our cells with insulin. So our cells develop something called insulin resistance. So the idea is to minimize the exposure to prevent the development of that insulin resistance. But once you, so eating and time-restricted eating strategies is a great way to maintain good health and a good cellular relationship between your body cells and your own body's insulin. But once you do become insulin resistance, we need to fast for longer periods of time so we can reinstill that insulin sensitivity in the body. Also, fasting for longer periods of time helps lower the level of insulin that has built up in the body over time. So this is where we get into the therapeutic fasts, which are 24, 30, 36, 42 hours. This is typically when people fast for one day, three times a week. And they'll do this till they heal their insulin resistance. So whether that means they're a woman who hasn't had a period in a few years due to PCOS, they start having regular cycles, or they're a diabetic who's no longer medication dependent and has a normal glucose response without consuming medication, that is our goal. So it typically takes between about 6 and 18 months, depending on the severity of the insulin resistance. We'll do more of this therapeutic fasting. So the goal is to, you know, drive the insulin levels down with a longer fast, but also, you know, absence makes the heart grow fonder. So it enables the cells to heal their relationship with your own insulin. So it's kind of like now in 2023, when I hear Adele's song, Hello, I'm so excited. I want to go see her in concert before my baby comes in Las Vegas. I now have Adele sensitivity because I'm no longer being bombarded, because it's not a brand new song anymore. So we want to give ourselves a bit of a break and reintroduce things periodically once the cells have healed. So that is my Adele explanation of insulin resistance, and really how it can help separate the understanding of time-restricted eating and intermittent fasting.
So then, is intermittent fasting not a lifelong practice?
So I was 27 years old. I'm now going to be 39. But when I was 27, the year before, I had just gained weight. You know how young women are warned by some of the older women in their family that enjoy it while you can. As soon as you turn 30, everything goes downhill. 40 pounds just shows up out of nowhere. All these lovely things my grandmothers and aunts told me were going to happen. So at 27, I had just rapidly gained a bunch of weight. I had PCOS, fatty liver, and type 2 diabetes. So of course, I treated fasting like a therapy. And I used this therapy to reverse my condition. At the end of 6 months, I was no longer clinically considered to be a type 2 diabetic, to have PCOS, or to have fatty liver disease. And I had lost 60 pounds. Now, this is going back 13 years ago almost, and I have maintained my weight loss. In fact, I've lost an additional 23 pounds up until pregnancy, and I'm starting to gain some baby. I've maintained great blood sugar levels and biomarkers, fatty liver, and no PCOS. I'm a pregnant lady today, approaching 40 years old. But for the last, 13 years, I have not done therapeutic fasting. So therapeutic fasting is done with the intention of healing disease. But once you're done healing your disease, you go back to healthy eating practices. If we go back to eating from sunrise to sunset, nonstop throughout the day, always producing insulin, eating processed and refined foods, we'll absolutely develop the metabolic disease. But largely what I've done is have 2 to 3 meals a day, really try not to snack. First trimester, pregnancy's a little hairy with that, I learned. but you really try not to snack and to focus on eating real whole foods. So I typically follow more of a paleo style diet, buying a lot from the farmer's market, shopping around the perimeter of the grocery store, and not buying a lot of boxed and prepackaged processed foods. And in embracing this lifestyle where I minimize the number of times a day I produce insulin, and I avoid the processed and refined foods as much as possible to avoid overproducing insulin, I have maintained exceptional health over the last decade. So it's not something that you need to do lifelong. Most people, once they heal from their insulin resistance, they then go into time-restricted eating to maintain that good health. And of course, we really try to transform the foods that people eat as well.
Yes. Share why you call fasting and starvation opposites. I think it fits in.
Yeah, so in the most general sense, fasting is an elective process you do for spiritual reasons or health reasons. It's part of every major religion in the world and has been, you know, since the beginning of human history. And largely, fasting is something that we can control. I can decide, you know, whether to fast today or whether to eat today. And if I want to eat, food is plentiful, available here in the Bay Area. Starvation is not something that you elect to do. It's not something you're doing for a health or a spiritual practice at all. You don't know when your next meal is coming from. Generally, there's very different physiological things that are present in individuals experiencing fasting versus starvation. So individuals electing to fast, say here in North America, we're a very overnourished population with obesity, unprecedented rates of 80% of the population has got some form of type 2 diabetes. We're more of an overfed group of individuals. We don't have a tremendous amount of nutrient deficiencies across the board. When we fast, we switch on these counter-regulatory hormones that help us access our body fat stores, but they produce things like human growth hormone that help us maintain our lean mass as well. And we have the body fat and we have the nutritional status that we're not going to go into severe states of malnutrition. Individuals who are not as fortunate as we are, large part of the population here, who don't know when their next meal is going to be available, they tend to have lower body fat percentages. They tend to have nutrient deficiencies and quite severe ones. So it's really important. You do work with someone who's knowledgeable. You do make sure that you have your registered healthcare provider on board. Even in individuals who aren't high risk, you know, we've always run baseline nutrient testing on them to make sure things like their phosphorus, calcium, all their levels are okay before we start fasting. You want to make sure you're in good nutrition.
That brings up two questions. One of them is, how is the amount of fuel you have in your body measured?
Well, essentially, our fat stores are just excess fuel. So I always liken it to this analogy. It's almost like the government has a mandate that says we must buy a full tank of fuel every day. So maybe your tank of fuel's eight gallons. That's what your tank can hold. But nowadays, a lot of people are working at home or working remotely. I might drive to the store. Today, I have to drive for blood work. You know, I'm going to drive like a whopping like 5 miles today at most. If there's a mandate that I must buy 8 gallons of fuel every day, and I'm only driving a few miles every day, then I'm going to have to store that excess fuel in gas containers so I can avoid the penalties associated with not getting my 8 liters a day. So I'm going to end up having to buy more gas containers. They're going to fill up my car, fill up my garage, fill up my backyard, and eventually create this toxic situation in my home. So what human beings are doing nowadays, we're eating all the time. We're constantly buying tanks of fuel without burning any of that fuel. We fill up our fat cells and then we generate more and more fat cells over time. So the more body fat we have, the more fuel that we have to burn.
Okay, so you can just look at someone and they're overweight and then you know they have excess fuel. And if someone is too thin, then you know they don't have enough. Simple as that.
We look at certain measurements like their body fat percentage and their lean mass ratios. So we'll look at body composition, or you can use BMI. So if someone has a BMI that's classified as underweight, we went work with them for therapeutic fasting. But, you know, most people do come to us, they have a BMI that's considered to be overweight.
Megan, inflammation and diabetes are two common health concerns for the general public. And let's move into the relation of how and where these hormones fit into the picture and what you've seen once that intermittent fasting is really rolling for someone.
Yeah, so this imbalance between insulin and our body's inability to utilize it with the constant overexposure due to the snacking all day and eating all day, and then the high volumes of it that we do tend to eat, because our food guidelines and food pyramids promote a diet that is largely processed and refined. And these foods cause our bodies to produce quite a lot of insulin in response. So once we're able to lower the insulin levels and to improve our cellular relationship with our own body's insulin, we find this has a cascading effect, especially for women and their sex hormones. A lot of this insulin imbalance and having high levels of insulin causes other sex hormone imbalances. And it leads to conditions such as estrogen dominance, where we're not producing enough progesterone, and we end up producing an overabundance of estrogen, which then further perpetuates the insulin resistance within the body. So once we're able to break through these cycles, we do see a lot of hormonal symptoms improve. So for women, we start to have regular menstrual cycles. We start to have cycles if someone hasn't had cycles, which is important. But from a type 2 diabetes perspective, we see a lot of people be able to come off their medications. There is a ton of patients that we saw in the clinic and people we work with every day who have been insulin-dependent diabetics for 20 or 30 years, who are now going on a decade of not requiring any insulin and having normal blood markers like the hemoglobin A1C, traditional doctors measure to determine diabetes risk factor. And they have a normal glucose response of food. So meaning if somebody did want to have a piece of birthday cake, they would have a normal glucose response like a non-diabetic. And most people can come off of their insulin, even with that prolonged history, within 3 to 6 months of doing therapeutic fasting, and then come off of additional oral diabetic medications while having this normal glucose response. We've also seen fasting radically reduce inflammatory markers in the body. So people with fibromyalgia, for example, who have been living in chronic pain, or people with rheumatoid arthritis, they experience a great improvement in their inflammatory state, and they're able to go on and live more fulfilling and healthy lifestyles.
Megan, this is so exciting. This is so helpful for so many people. I'm sorry that your own physical condition brought you to this place, but what a gift, ultimately.
It's just really rewarding. Prior to my own diagnosis, I was in the medical field, and it was so disheartening. You know, I started working with kidney patients when I was 15 years old. And my first summer internship there were barely any patients on dialysis. And most of the patients who were on dialysis at that time had it due to a hereditary condition or autoimmune condition. Then flash forward a decade, we were dialyzing thousands of patients 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We were airlifting them 3 to 5 hours away for dialysis, because in the city of Toronto, which is one of the largest cities in North America, we didn't have enough space. And it was largely due to the diabetes epidemic. And every day I went in and there's another death, another mortality of a patient that you grow to really know and to care for. And there's nothing you can do. All you do is watch their demise. And it was absolutely devastating. You know, for me, I realized that there's a lot in medicine that's the job, is just management until the end. And I really wanted to help people and help them get better. I did have to go through some not great disease processes myself, but I'm so happy for the collaboration I've had with my partner, Dr. Jason Fung, his research and insights, my experimentation, and my ability to reverse my illness. Because now every day I go to work and all you hear about is people actually getting better from this disease, you know, primarily type 2 diabetes that they're told is chronic and progressive. And there's so many women too, you know, who've been told they can't have kids. Their PCOS is so bad. They've run out of money through IVF treatment and they're just getting pregnant naturally, 42 years old. Pretty amazing. It's just wonderful. I love waking up every day because we get to make people's lives better.
Beautiful. And is there another basic to know that comes to mind right now for you about our hormonal response to food?
So it was really also not about the calories, which I think a lot of people have a struggle wrapping their mind around. You can have 150 calories from a can of soda, and you can have 150 calories from a handful of almonds. And most of us know that that soda isn't going to aid in our weight loss effort. In fact, it can cause weight gain. And most of us know if we're diabetic that it's just going to worsen our blood sugars, whereas the almonds don't. It's not just looking about the calories. It's looking about how the calories affect those hormones. You can eat 150 calories from three cookies, or you can eat 150 calories of salmon. You're going to have very different hormonal responses to those foods. So remember, it's really not necessarily about the calories. Calories are not the be-all and the end-all, while they do matter. It's really about the hormonal response that they have. Trying to shift from that mentality, I think, is really important. One thing I always ask somebody is, you know, what are five real foods that you would cut out of your diet if you're trying to lose weight or lower your blood sugar? And without fail, I hear things like corn, rice, potatoes, bread, pasta. And then we say to these individuals, well, okay, these are all low-calorie, low-fat foods. So why are you cutting out the low-calorie, low-fat foods to lose weight if that's your weight loss strategy, is low-calorie, low-fat, if they're the ones causing weight gain? So it's not all about the calories. It is about the hormonal response. It's a paradox or a paradigm shift that a lot of people have to wrap their minds around as well in order to maintain their good health in the long run.
Yes, and perhaps you just moved into answering my next question, which is, what is the biggest misconception about IF, intermittent fasting? Is that it?
A lot of people just think it's an extreme calorie restriction diet. I actually saw it on this weekend online a bunch. But how it differs from calorie restriction is the production of these counter-regulatory hormones. So say you reduce your caloric intake by, you know, 500 calories a day. Over time, your body might overspend metabolic energy and you might lose weight. But then your body adapts to the new budget. So if you cut your calories down, say, to 1,200 calories a day, you give your body, say, a $1,200 a day budget. So it will slow down certain processes like reproductive, cognitive, respiratory, cardiovascular processes. It will slow things down to meet the new budget. So this is why over time, people who do calorie restriction diets end up plateauing. They'll lose some weight at the beginning because they're overspending at the beginning. Kind of like if your household income got slashed by 20% for various reasons. It might take you a couple of months to figure out how to rebudget your household income so you're not overspending and going into debt now that you've had that reduction in money available. When you're fasting, you're really giving your body nothing, or you're giving it a few calories from some green tea or from a cup of coffee, maybe a few extra from a cup of broth here and there, but that's it. So your body can't budget on that. There's nothing to budget on. So you do have the sympathetic nervous system response that active the production of these counter-regulatory hormones that help us liberate body fat, help us maintain our lean mass by generating human growth hormone, help reduce glucose if we need it during the fast. And this is the big nervous system response is the biggest differentiator between the two. If we're not giving our bodies anything, then it's got to tap into our stores. And when it makes the energy adjustment to tap into our stores, we release plentiful food fuel from our fat cells. So when we look at all the randomized control trials, which are the gold standard in medical research that compare alternate daily fasting to calorie restriction diets, we not only see that the alternate daily fasting group has more fat loss, more trunk fat loss, but it also has a better retention of lean mass in each RCT that's been produced comparing the two. And there's been several now over the last decade. We don't see any change in the resting metabolic rate in the alternate daily fasting group. Each RCT has demonstrated a clinically significant reduction in the resting metabolic rate of the calorie restriction group. So when we're fasting, the production of these counter-regulatory hormones doesn't actually slow down our metabolic rate. It actually meets our metabolic needs if we have plentiful fat fuel. Whereas the calorie restriction group, we're just slowing things down to acclimate to a new caloric budget.
Yes. And Megan, how specialized a process is intermittent fasting? Can we pick up your book, The Essential Guide to Intermittent Fasting, figure out a protocol or do it and be successful? Is it tricky finding the appropriate schedule?
Some people who have more health concerns than others do find that they require some assistance. Regardless, you should always let your registered healthcare provider know. Some medications, like blood pressure medications and diabetes medications, do need to be monitored because they likely will have to be reduced over time. So it's always important to check with your healthcare provider, regardless of how healthy or unhealthy you may think that you are. The third part of the book provides a pretty comprehensive how-to plan with recommendations for how to get started and where to go, what to look for with fasting. And of course, if you find that you need a partner, Jason Fong and I, we have a fasting coaching program and an online community that can help provide additional support for these individuals.
Wonderful. And there's a good sense of self-empowerment, isn't there? It would follow, certainly, to have a very nonlinear effect on our entire life, wouldn't it?
It's been really wild to hear all of the transformations. One of the first patients, he was the first patient we took off of insulin. He said he would get so tired tying up his shoes. He couldn't even imagine going into the grocery store with his wife. He would drive her there. And then about 6 months later, after his consultation, his wife came into the clinic with him and said, "Megan, you need to remind my husband that he's an old man. He's a 73-year-old man." And the reason why she was so flustered was because he helped assist in shoveling 10 driveways that day after a snowstorm. Mm-hmm. So it's just really wild. I had a client yesterday who took her grandkids on a trip. And she said, you know, a year ago, she never would have been able to. She had too many doctor's appointments, too many medications, lots that needed to be refrigerated. And she said she could barely even take care of herself every day. But she took all six of her grandkids on a solo trip on a Disney cruise and had a real blast. So it's just really nice to hear people, yes, they're getting healthier, but their quality of their lives are improving so much.
And I did read somewhere that initially your mentor and fellow doctor researcher, Dr. Fong, explored this avenue connecting religion, fasting, spirituality, and health. And it sounds pretty well grounded to me from that aspect, especially.
Yeah, you know, I think Jason and I had a lot of success bringing this to people in Toronto because fasting wasn't foreign to anybody, whether, you know, they were Hindu, they fasted once a week, or whether they participated in Ramadan. People fasted for various religious practices. And I remember my grandmother saying, you know, Lent used to be 40 days of fasting, not 40 days without beer or chocolate. Fasting is not new. It's the oldest dietary strategy that there probably ever was. Yeah.
Thank goodness there is now your intermittent fasting clinic. But if Joe or Sue go to their doctor, how likely are they going to bump into the doctor that says, oh, that's a terrible idea?
Jason and I started our clinic 12 years ago, and we saw a lot of pushback from our colleagues. Flash forward a year later, we had a wait list that was 18 months long. So the tide is turning. I would hang in there and encourage patients to be patient.
Beautiful. I'm going to make the jump and say that the male hormones would have a similar reaction and action toward health with this program.
Absolutely. Over 50% of the people we've worked with have been men. And the first and third part of this book actually are just as applicable to men as they are to women. It's the same strategies.
Megan Ramos, I love how science is coming around to exploring and confirming what's been known for eons and eons. For anything tributaries related, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.